first of all, let go of the idea that there's a right way or time to orgasm. This is your sexual pleasure. It doesn't belong to anybody else, and it shouldn't be compared to anybody else. So start with that, just some self-love and some acceptance. Then, if you'd like to start to work with this, one of the tools I recommend is as you're having sex and you're receiving pleasure, when you find yourself caught in the mind, caught in thoughts about not orgasming fast enough, just use that tool of coming back to pleasure, coming back to your body. And this is going to take a lot of practice at first, but after a while, just like with a regular mindfulness practice, you'll become more and more capable of returning to your body, returning to pleasure. It doesn't mean you need to quiet the thoughts. You don't need to turn them off. Just notice that they're there and come back to the body. Now, ideally, with a partner, you can share that you're having this anxiety. Some women I've met have trouble having orgasms at all during sex with a partner. And I want to offer a technique that you could play around with and see if it works for you if you're having this challenge. First of all, let go of the idea that there's anything wrong with you. You're great just the way you are. If you'd like to work on orgasm with a partner, here's some tools. Start by bringing attention to the genital area while having sex or receiving any kind of sexual pleasure. Communicate what feels good, how much pressure, what pace, all of these things matter. And the more you can communicate about what feels good, the easier it will be for you to move towards climax. Remember, you can use the tools of communication from earlier in the lesson if you're feeling shy or embarrassed about talking about what you want. Once you've been clear about what feels good for you, keep your attention on the genitals. One way to sensitize yourself to this part of the body is to squeeze the pelvic floor muscles and then release them. This is also called a Kegel, which you may have heard of. So you'll just squeeze and release. Squeeze and release. Staying in touch with the sensations of pleasure in the genitals. Don't put any pressure on yourself to have an orgasm or have an orgasm right away. Just start this as a practice. Over time, you'll start to notice that you get more tuned into pleasure, less caught up in anxiety and worry, and most likely you can work towards having orgasms with a partner. It's also completely acceptable to use toys and to use different ways of having an orgasm. Do what works for you. We all have unique bodies. So pay attention to what yours likes. It's really important that we share our anxieties with our partners. So if you're having a lot of anxiety about orgasming or about any other part of sex, let your partner know. Sit down and share it with them. And again, if you're feeling nervous about talking, use the practice of focusing on thoughts and emotions. Use the practice of relaxation and then come back. Come back to communicating, to connecting, and to sharing your anxieties. As you do this, the anxieties will lessen. Just talking about it will help. So, relax and enjoy. During this exploration of mindful sex, you've heard me mention deeper intimacy and connection a few times. And in this lesson, I'd like to explore that more deeply. You've heard the term becoming one during sex. And that's actually possible. It's actually possible to truly feel connected on that deep of a level with your partner. It requires all the tools we've been exploring so far. And there are ways to enhance it even more. And I'll be guiding you in a meditation for that. But first, just take a moment and think about what kind of connection you'd like to have with a partner. Whether this is a long-term partner or a partner for the night. How would you like to be connected? What's meaningful for you? This is what makes the connection. Your values, what's meaningful for you, what excites you, what turns you on. Anything that I share with you is just an invitation. it's up to you to dive into your sexual creativity, your sexual imagination, and find out what you want. My favorite way to help people feel a deep sense of unity during sex is a meditation called flow. Flow is simply anything that's moving or changing. And so right now, you can just notice your breath. As you breathe in, there's movement in the body. And as you exhale, there's movement in the body. The lungs expand and contract. The diaphragm expands and contracts. Maybe the shoulders lift and release. There's the movement of air through your nostrils. All of that would be considered flow. You can take a moment now and notice sounds around you. The sound of my voice, maybe the sounds of someone in the next room, sounds of the street outside or a dog barking. All of that is also moving and changing. You can do the same thing with thoughts, with emotional sensations, and with sights as well. If you go out into nature and you just watch the trees moving in the breeze and the birds flying around, that's a version of flow too. So we can bring this into sex. The tastes, the smells, the sensations, the sights, they're all constantly moving and changing. When you get in touch with that while you're having sex, you can start to really feel connected to your partner. So I'd like to guide you through this flow meditation, and then we'll talk a little more about bringing it into sex. You can start by closing your eyes and bring your attention to your body, just like we did all the way back in the beginning. Just noticing the sensations of your face, sensations in your neck, your shoulders, any sensations in your arms or your hands. Notice how your chest feels. Feel into any sensations in the abdomen. Notice any sensation in your back. Now bringing your attention to your hips and your seat and your pelvic area. Just feeling any sensations that are there. You don't have to create anything and you don't have to get rid of anything. Just paying attention to what's present. Now feeling into any sensations in your legs. And all the way down to your feet. And then zooming out and getting a sense of your whole body. From this embodied place, I'd like you to bring your attention to your breath. Start to pay attention to the movement and change that's occurring in the body as you breathe. Get really interested in that flow sensation. If it's helpful, as you feel the sensation, you can just quietly in your mind label flow. That's just to help facilitate mindfulness. If it's not helpful for you, you don't have to do it. Feeling the expansion and the contraction of each inhale and each exhale. Now begin to move your attention around the body, noticing any other areas where there's flow present. There might be a tingle somewhere, a wave of sensation somewhere, an undulation somewhere in the body. There might be a big burst of sensation somewhere, a contraction, an expansion. There's flow in pleasant sensations, neutral sensations, and unpleasant sensations. So you can explore any of these. Keep getting really curious about the way it feels, this movement and change in your body. Now you can begin to bring your attention to sound. Sound of my voice, sounds in the next room, sounds outside. And I want you to, in particular, pay attention to the movement and change of these sounds. The way sound flows. Let yourself deeply encounter this flow of sound. As we're practicing this flow meditation, you may have noticed some thoughts. I'd like you now to bring your attention to thought. This could be auditory or visual. And what I want you to pay attention to is the flow of this mental activity. So we're not trying to stop the thinking. Instead, we're getting really interested in how the thoughts bubble up, spread out, and vanish. How the images move and change. How the pitch and pace and volume of mental talk is always shifting just a little. Get really interested, really curious in the flow of mental activity. And now if you'd like, open your eyes just a little. Start to let in some light. And start to become aware of any flow in sight. So if you're looking at me, my mouth is moving, parts of my body are moving a little bit, that's flow. You also might be aware of a tree out the window, leaves moving in the wind. Or some other kind of flow in the visual field. So just take a moment to experience that. Now you can go ahead and close your eyes again. And I want to invite you to let go into the flow of sensation, sound, and thought. Without directing your attention anywhere in particular, just drop in to that constant movement and change in the body, in the mind, and in the sounds of your environment. Diving in to flow. And as you do this practice, if you need to go back to one of the other techniques, you're always welcome to do that. Maybe you get really pulled into thoughts and you need to just observe them for a moment. Give them some acknowledgement. Or maybe you start to feel some pain in the body or an intense emotion. You can notice that, give that some space, or you could turn to relaxation and just take a moment to settle the system. All of these tools work together. And as you're ready, you come right back to flow. Noticing even your awareness, it gathers around something and then it moves and gathers around something else, a sensation, a sound, a thought. Even your awareness is flowing. Take another moment to really drop into flow. And I want to invite you to notice flow that's pleasurable, since ultimately you'll be trying this out during sex. Take a moment now to notice pleasurable flow in the body, mind, or in the sounds around you. Relaxing into the flow. Going with the flow. If at any time you're doing this technique and you get confused or lose track of what you're doing, you can always come back to the simple flow of your breathing. Your breathing is always flowing, moving and changing with every inhale and every exhale. Okay, you can now open your eyes as we come to the end of this flow meditation. You can probably imagine how good sex will feel if you bring in this technique. You can start by simply feeling the sensation of your partner's body moving against yours. Sensation of their fingertips touching your body or their skin under your fingertips. However you have sex, there's always going to be some movement and change, and you can start to pay attention to that. Another thing you can do is start to synchronize your breathing with your partner. You can start this before sex. Just sit together and breathe in and out together, synchronizing your breathing. Maybe even looking into each other's eyes as you do this. And then as you begin to move into sexual activity, keep your breathing synced up. It's a really easy way to be in touch with flow during sex. And then all those waves and spikes of pleasure, you can really notice the flow in that. And as you do this, you just may become tuned in to the flow occurring in your partner's body. And this is where things get really, really interesting. This is where you might start to experience that mystical experience of oneness, unity. Ultimately, sex and sexuality can be a spiritual path. Or if you're not interested in the word spiritual, it can just be an adventure. So dive into the flow and check it out for yourself. Thank you so much for joining me for this exploration of mindful sex. I want to let you know that there is no graduation date here. There's no getting it right. This is an exploration. It's an adventure. So pay attention to the journey. Don't get too caught up on the destination. And enjoy yourself. Everything in my lessons for Masters of Mindfulness is also in my book, along with lots of other techniques and exercises to improve your sex life. My book is called Good Sex, Getting Off Without Checking Out, and it's available wherever books are sold. You can also find out more about me and my work at yourwildawakening.com. I offer virtual sessions for couples as well as individuals in areas of sexuality, spirituality, and creativity. Feel free to get in touch if I can be of any help to you.
Coming up, you'll explore the emotion of awe with Professor Dacher Keltner, and you'll learn how to find awe in your daily life.
So what was endowed into human beings was this defining quality or strength called awe or reverence or our capacity to find things to be sacred and meaningful.
Lecture 17. Awe, a defining human emotion.
Dr. Dacher Keltner is a professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley, and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center. His research focuses on the biological and evolutionary origins of compassion, awe, love, beauty, power, social class, and inequality. Dacher is the professor you always wish you had. He is truly dedicated to knowledge as a means of bringing the greater good to this world.
It's a real privilege to take you on a tour of the science and practice of awe today. Awe is a defining emotion and a really important property of the human mind in our social culture. The great Greek philosopher Protagoras told a really interesting origin story about the origin of the human species that resembles a lot of the origin stories, which is, as God was giving out the different skills and traits to the different species, he gave away all the physical characteristics like strength and speed and ferocity. And when it came to humans, there weren't that many skills left over, and so what was endowed into human beings was this defining quality or strength called awe or reverence or our capacity to find things to be sacred and meaningful. This idea that awe is a defining human emotion is seen across time. The great physicist Einstein said that the most beautiful thing that we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source, and I think he was talking about awe, of all true art and science. So I'm going to be approaching awe largely as an emotional state that's part of our repertoire of emotions that make humans what humans are. And we think in the field of emotions as really brief, multi-component responses that involve physiology and experience and expressive behavior that really help humans navigate the immediate environment that they're in, most typically a social environment, in ways that benefits their goals and concerns. So emotions are these ways of interacting with the environment. So as we define awe, what's first important, given the complexity of this emotion and this phenomenon, is really to differentiate awe from related phenomena so that you have a kind of a clear idea of what we're talking about as we move through the science and practice of awe. So awe is the feeling of being in the presence of things that are vast and that you don't have knowledge to immediately understand, and they require that you revise your beliefs and knowledge about the world. So awe has vastness in it, temporal or physical or psychological, and then it challenges your knowledge structure so you don't really know how to make sense of what you're perceiving. We differentiate awe, for example, from related states like astonishment, where you're astonished by the beauty of a sunset, but it's less intense than awe, and it doesn't kind of sort of subvert your knowledge structures. You'll see there's a lot of thinking about how awe is really different from beauty. A beautiful sunset or a beautiful field of flowers or a beautiful face or the beauty of a laugh of a young child. Most typically we think of beauty as being less powerful, involving for the person more agency. You have more control. You don't feel like you're losing control as you do with awe. Philosophers have been interested in a state called wonder. Wonder, in fact, fueled Newton and Descartes to try to figure out the physics of the rainbow. Why is it that when water, light moves through water, it bends in particular ways that produces rainbows? This sort of state of wonder, which we define as the curiosity and amazement you feel about things and a search for understanding, is really different from awe. It's more of a knowledge-seeking state. And then finally, we differentiate awe from something that Thomas Jefferson was really interested in, as well as John Haidt, which is elevation, where you just feel elevated or inspired by the moral goodness of other people. You may see a teenager help an elderly woman get her cat out of the tree, as I did one day, and get a rush of tears and goosebumps, and that's really elevation as opposed to awe. And then finally, we differentiate awe from epiphanies. The poet T.S. Eliot was really interested in epiphanies, which is the sudden realization of something really deep and meaningful about your life or about the world, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be vast, like awe, but it's this sudden realization of a truth. And T.S. Eliot wrote beautifully about how sometimes you might see a natural event like a leaf falling, and it makes you realize some truth about your life, that your parents are getting older and perhaps heading into the end of life. So we differentiate awe from things like astonishment and beauty and wonder and elevation and then intellectual epiphany. Awe, like all of the emotions and like every human construct, has a phenomenally rich and interesting cultural history, if you will, that really charts how it has a core to it but changes over time. Awe early in human history, in the written record, was really an emotion that was intertwined with religious experience. It was filled with sort of the dread and uncertainty and deep humbleness you might feel or people felt 2,500 years ago when they encountered God. It is filled with wonder. So there are famous stories, for example, the prophet Ezekiel feels awe, and has a sense of God when looking at lightning in the clouds, in these dramatic clouds. In Hinduism, Arjuna, one of the great figures in the legends of Hinduism, has this experience of awe or vismaya in looking out in the world through God's eye. And then there's a famous story, very typical of these sort of accounts of awe, sort of feeling dread and wonder and fear in relationship to God, of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, where he had this conversion experience and through the encountering of a bright light and the voice of God. So early in its history, when you study how humans were writing about awe in religious texts across different religions, it really is an emotion of dread and wonder vis-a-vis a sort of a supernatural force. Then awe really transforms dramatically in the era of enlightenment in the 18th century, and in large part thanks to the dramatic writing, I would even call it radical writing, of the Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. In 1757, he published a book, A Philosophical Inquiry into Our Ideas About the Origins of the Sublime and the Beautiful. So you see this pulling apart that Immanuel Kant was interested in as well, of what is awe-inspiring or the sublime versus what is beautiful. And what Burke does is he takes this experience and he secularizes it. He brings it into our everyday perceptual experience that you might have as you move through the day. It's not just a religious experience. It's really a particular kind of psychological perceptual experience. And what Burke contends is that the two key qualities of awe are that the thing is powerful vis-a-vis you and it's obscure. You can't make it out. You can't figure it out. Your knowledge can't sort of make sense of it and has to come up with an explanation. And that's why we define awe as involving vastness and the need to revise your knowledge structures. So Burke writes incredibly about how awe is triggered by shadows and loud sounds like thunder and large, powerful animals like the ox, right? And clouds and the sky, all natural events, not necessarily religious events, that trigger this feeling of the sublime or what you might call awe in human beings. Burke does a lot of really creative work in differentiating awe from beauty. And beauty, he really writes, as being a softer emotional response. It's more about soft features of things you see, sort of rolling hills, soft curves to a baby's face, smoothness, these more kind of pleasing qualities to what you're perceiving as a source of beauty. So Burke, very importantly, takes awe out of the purely religious realm and brings it into our everyday experience. And then a final awe revolutionary, if you will, or an awe pioneer, of course, is Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of the great writers in the American Transcendentalist movement, and does, again, a lot of contemporary thinking for us in taking awe and taking it into our experience in nature. And we're going to be returning to this theme throughout our discussion today. So I love this quote of Ralph Waldo Emerson writing in his essay on nature from 1836, where he says, "In the woods we return to reason and faith. There I feel that nothing can befall me in life, no disgrace, no calamity, leaving my eyes, which nature cannot repair. Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes." So Emerson's talking here about this experience many of you probably have had, which is we get out into our favorite part of nature. We may be on a walk that we particularly enjoy, and the sense of self starts to fade. We feel an expansion of who we are, and we no longer care about the more egotistical concerns of life. And Emerson did a lot to kind of advocate for nature, a theme that was picked up in the environmentalist movement, for example, as a source of awe. We also learn a lot about awe from the very important psychologist William James, who wrote this very important book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, and in 1902 published the book. And what he was making the case for, and he surveyed what Puritan preachers' visions were like and what enlightenment was like in Buddhist traditions and what kind of transcendent states felt like in Hinduism and what happens when people do yoga. James himself experimented with laughing gas, brought all of these first-person narratives and accounts of experiences into this remarkable book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And what he said is that there's this mystical core to these experiences where you lose a sense of the boundaries between self and other. You lose a sense of time. You feel deeply interconnected, that has awe at its core as an important part of the religious experience across religions. Very radical and important idea. So the first way that we answer the question of like, what is awe, is we differentiate it from related states, which we've done, like beauty and wonder and epiphany, and then we trace its cultural history. And then another way in which we get insight into the nature of an emotion is we think about, well, where does it come from, right? What is the context that I'm in that makes me feel this particular emotion? Where does awe come from? Where do we feel it? You know, when you consult your own experience, it comes from many different things. So when I think about my life in Berkeley, I think about how I felt awe in reading Mahatma Gandhi and his thinking about sort of the kind of commonalities of human beings. I feel awe when I'm lucky enough to go travel to a beautiful cathedral and see the stained glass of Sainte-Chapelle. I feel awe when I travel to up in the mountains and see the peaks of the Himalayas or travel into the Sierras like John Muir did. I feel awe when I contemplate how wonderful food can be, or go to great cultural artifacts like the Chichen Itza pyramids. I feel awe when I think about the free speech movement in 1964, where students kind of advocated for free speech that led to various protests against war and the like. And this is a personal bias, but I feel awe, like many young people, about rock and roll figures, Iggy Pop being my favorite. So to get a handle on this deep question of how do humans feel awe? What do they feel awe about? Where are they? What's happening? What are the psychological themes that trigger awe, right? And that tells us what this important emotion is. My colleagues at Berkeley and I have actually surveyed thousands of people in 26 different countries. And this is countries of all the great religious traditions, countries of different degrees of economic wealth, countries that vary in their sense of being more collective, like China, or more individualistic, like the United States, countries that vary in their degree of education. We've surveyed 26 different countries and the people there, and we just asked them, like, write about an experience of awe and what was going on. And here's what we find. We find that the most common source of awe is other people, and I'm going to talk about that in just a second. So in a sense, Burke was right. Awe comes from the marvels of other people and our social lives. A second most prominent source of awe is nature. And around the world, whether you're in a desert in part of Africa or you're in the mountains of Scandinavia, nature is a common source of awe. A third common source of awe worldwide is spirituality, is contemplative practice, religion, the rituals, for example, going to a Catholic service. And then there are other less common sources of awe that are really important, like art and music and architecture and the like. So let's drill down a bit and just sort of give you some specifics about what causes awe as a way to think about what awe is. We were struck in surveying 2,600 people in 26 countries that other people are a underappreciated and most common source of awe. We are awestruck by people's kindness and their virtuosity. You might hear a little child play the piano and just be awestruck by how good they are. We are awestruck by big people, right? If they're 7 feet tall, it makes us feel awestruck. We're awestruck by people's heroism, somebody who overcomes really challenging life circumstances to do good in the world. Unexpectedly, we found that childbirth and kind of the spectacular qualities of that process and the fact that life comes out of it was a very common source of awe across countries. So other people, their magnanimity, their kindness, their virtuosity, their strength really give our common source of awe. A second source is nature. This should be really intuitive to you. People write about one of our Chinese participants was their village was flooded and just watching the waters rise. People are awestruck by sunsets and waves and trees and vast trees that I live nearby that are 360 feet tall, vistas, tornadoes, lightning, earthquakes. This idea that awe and the mysteries are intertwined with nature finds its way in various philosophies. In Taoism, which is 2,500 years old, that comes from Chinese thought, there's Lao Tzu, who's the great first practitioner of Taoism, and he really writes about, and I love this quote, about Tao, the mysterious force of life, the deep meaning of life, Lao Tzu writes, is like water, in that it, in its own interconnected way, interacts and benefits many different things around it, but doesn't compete or contest with those things. And Lao Tzu really thought that that kind of sense of the vital life force in us is, or what you might think of as a feeling of awe, is has these properties of water. Drilling down again, what is awe? It's found in, we'll return to the neuroscience of this, in prayer, contemplation. People, when they do meditation or mindful practices, will very often sort of be struck by a sense of awe about what it can bring to them, what the qualities of their mind are like. And then as I've noted, there are these other sort of sources of awe that we shouldn't lose sight of. People feel awe at political rallies, at sporting events, people tell us from the 26 different country study. People feel awe very commonly in collective activities, that Barbara Ehrenreich has written about, that dances and festivals and celebrations and weddings and even funerals, there's a sense of awe in the transcendent. People commonly feel awe in encountering remarkable architectural structures, paintings, poetry. And then it's really interesting and gives me reason for my own career, which is that people feel awe about ideas. When a person first hears of how DNA works or how evolution works, or, you know, when Charles Darwin was in the Amazonian rainforest and he was looking at this multiplicity of species and he started to get a sense, very vague sense in the 1830s when he's a young man about how natural selection may be creating all this incredible beauty in the South American Amazonian rainforest, he felt awe and wonder and had to figure it out. And people feel awe about technology. A rocket ship or whatever the case may be, will be a source of awe. So just to wrap up our thinking about what is awe, there are a few other things that we've learned that I think are really important for you to know. First of all is awe is, much more common in people's ordinary experience than you might imagine. The word awe very often makes you think, I had it once in my life. It was when, I met Bono in an ice cream store and he gave me his ice cream cone or whatever the case may be. But in point of fact, when we do rigorous research, figuring out how often people feel awe, they feel it about 2 to 2.5 times a week. It's subtler forms of awe, but still important. A second point is awe, I've given you a sort of a positive version of awe, and we're going to delve into that in more detail. But about a quarter of people's awe experiences are fearful and they feel threatening and they have a layer of uncertainty. And they elevate, our research shows, your stress-related physiology. Your heart rate goes up and you have higher blood pressure. You know, a young child may, when they first hear about the universe and that we're, the role we have in the universe and how small it is and how short and fleeting life is, often they'll have this form of awe that is almost imbued, that's imbued with anxiety. And so that's about a quarter of the experiences that people have, has this fear layer to awe. And then a third issue that I think you should be thinking about is how awe shifts from one culture to another, right? This science is young, so we're just starting to learn this. But what we're learning, for example, is that awe in China, a more collectivist, hierarchical culture, tends to involve more hierarchy, and you feel a little bit more submissive when you're feeling awe as opposed to if you feel awe in many parts of the United States. And in fact, when you look at the Chinese ideograms that map onto awe, they translate to fearful respect. So awe is really deferential or submissive. So we should be attentive and thought and mindful to cultural differences in awe as well. So when we wrap this up, what is awe? As you can see, awe is this complicated family of states. It's about other people. It's about spirituality. It's about nature, ideas, art, architecture, music, great technology. It is many different things, and important to bear that in mind.
Lecture 18. How can you find more awe?
So now that we know a little bit more about what awe is, let's ask the question, what does awe do for us? What functions does awe serve in human interactions? This is actually something that we use to think about the nature of emotion, which is to think about how do emotions help us solve problems in our social interactions and sort of help us capitalize upon opportunities that are really important to our survival. To help make sense of awe, we're going to rely on this concept of ultrasociality, which E.O. Wilson, the great biologist, wrote about in his book, The Social Conquest of Earth, which is he said that the defining strength of the human species and how we defended ourselves and took care of vulnerable young and got food for our survival and so forth, was we did this socially in really tight social groups. Now, you may be surprised to learn that this idea that our communal tendencies, our collective tendencies are really a deep part of our evolution actually traces back to Charles Darwin. And Darwin, in The Descent of Man, wrote about how sympathy and a lot of the pro-social emotions like awe, and I'll talk about gratitude really briefly, will actually have been increased through natural selection, and I'm quoting Darwin here, for those communities which included the greatest number of the most sympathetic members will flourish the best and rear the greatest number of offspring. So what Darwin is arguing before E.O. Wilson is that to survive as a species, we really need to survive in strong communities. So what does this really mean in more specific terms? Well, one of the sort of implications of this analysis is that if we're going to survive as an ultra-social species in strong social groups, what we have to do or what we have to have are mechanisms that help us move away from gratifying our self-interest to really honoring and acting in ways that benefit the interests of others. And various people, from economist Robert Frank to philosopher Elliot Sober, have really grappled with this complicated question, which is, we're not just self-interest machines. We really have to have particular emotions and tendencies and ways of interacting with each other that benefit others first and often sacrifice self-interest. That is really at the heart of being an ultra-social species. So, in light of this concept of ultra-sociality and sort of transcending self-interest in the service of others, a variety of different scholars, from David Hume to Adam Smith to Charles Darwin to Martha Nussbaum more recently, have really been making the case that there are certain emotions that capture our physiology, that direct attention, that motivate behaviors, that help us act in the service of other people, and momentarily ignore our own self-interest. So you could think about, for example, compassion, the feeling of concern for an individual in need and the motivation to help, as being one form of an emotion that helps us benefit others, even if it costs ourselves. A lot of people have written about gratitude, another moral emotion, where you really feel reverential for things that people give to you, and you will sacrifice in the future to kind of balance out that gift as another kind of moral emotion that helps us serve others. And so that raises this question of what does awe do within this conceptual framework? And so what I'm going to argue is that this amazing experience of awe that comes from nature and other people and social groups and contemplative practice and other kinds of sources like art and music, it does a couple of really important things that help us fold into social collectives to make for strong social groups. First of all, we're going to see that it really shifts your attention and what you care about away from your own self-interest, what you desire and want, to a focus on other people's interests and their concerns. So it, in a way, quiets the voice of self-interest and turns up the volume on your awareness of other people's interests. And then the second thing that we're going to see is that awe helps us fold into social collectives and makes for these ultra-social strong groups by motivating and producing more altruistic cooperative behavior, a foundation of human social living. So how does awe transform the self? In Japanese, they write about this interesting state called kando. And kando is a state where it literally is the state where the self vanishes like light or wind on water. It's as if you see it for a minute and then it disappears. And so we're going to ask the question of how in the world does awe produce this reduced sense of self? Before we do, just think for a moment about what the psychology of the self tells us. So when I think about the self, Dacher Keltner, my goals and my characteristics and what I'm, my intentions in the world, when I have this self-focus, what happens is I tend to be more self-critical. I tend to ruminate about what I'm doing. I'm more goal-driven. I'm a little bit more anxious, which is something to worry about. I'm a little bit less attentive to other people's interests. I'm less cooperative in social situations. So self-focus has a place in human existence, which is it's about making sure you gratify your self-interest and do well in according ways. Awe, we're going to argue, actually quiets that very loud voice of the self and opens up your mind to other people's interests and their characteristics. One of my favorite poetic reflections upon this was John Muir, the great naturalist who started the Sierra Club here in California. Muir, as many of you know, used to take sheep out into the Sierras and go out there by himself and spend time and go to Yosemite and live out in the wild. And it really changed his life. And he has this wonderful quote where he writes, "We are now in the mountains and they are in us, kindling enthusiasm, making every nerve quiver, filling every pore and cell of us. Our flesh and bone tabernacle," and what he's talking about there is our sense of self, "seems transparent as glass to the beauty about us, as if truly an inseparable part of it, thrilling with the air and the trees, the streams and rocks and the waves of the sun, a part of nature." So what he's really talking about here is this fascinating process that people have written about with respect to awe, which is the boundaries between the sense of self, the boundaries between self and other seem to disappear. Our flesh and bone tabernacle is transparent to other things around it. So let me tell you what we've learned about this. In some research, we actually in China, in the United States, every night for a couple of weeks, people wrote about, did they experience awe today, right? Or did they experience other positive emotions like joy, where you feel really like life's burdens have lifted and you feel joyful. We sort of keep track of people's narratives. And then each day we gather a measure of how much are they thinking about themselves? How self-focused are they? Right. And what we find across these 2 weeks, both in China and the United States is that if you've had an awe experience during the day, you go to a garden in Beijing and it's the flowers are blooming and you're struck with awe at the blooming of the flowers, your sense of self becomes smaller compared to the control condition, which was joy. We did another experiment, more dramatic. In this particular case, our researchers stopped people from all over the world at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, this highly visited place. Lots of tourists go there. It's right on the bay. It's beautiful. You ride on the trolley car. A lot of fun, right? Or you go to Yosemite Valley. And Yosemite is this incredible valley, glacially formed, gives people awe. And all we did is we had them draw a picture of themselves on a piece of graph paper, right? Really simple, kind of fun. They drew these pictures of themselves. And then sneakily, we sort of counted up how many squares occupied that sense of self. And what you find is that if you're in the wonders of Yosemite, the sense of self is really small compared to if you're at Fisherman's Wharf. Even though it's just as pleasurable and fun when you're on vacation, it's smaller. What we also find in this research is as my sense of self sort of gets smaller and starts to vanish, I am aware of the much stronger connections that I have to other people in my social network. As my mind is less attuned to the self, I'm aware of how supportive and strongly connected other people are to me. So a really nice benefit of this vanishing of the self. Another benefit to the vanishing or the diminishing of the self is this ethic of humility that a lot of people have been interested in for quite some time. We think about humility really having two different attributes, which is you have a realistic view of yourself, including your faults, right? Well, I tend to overstate things or whatever the case may be. And then the second attribute of humility is that you really have this openness to the strengths of other people, right? You are aware of your own sense of self and you are appreciative or open to the strengths of other people. So here's what we did, and we've done a variety of studies showing that momentary experiences of awe make us more humble, which should really help us fold into social collectives. In this study, students went up to the top of this tower on the Berkeley campus. It's a high tower, a couple hundred feet tall. They looked out at this beautiful view of the Bay Area. The other conditioned students sat on a beautiful part of campus, right? It was pleasing. They were calm, had those qualities. And at the end of that experience, we just had them kind of rate how humble they felt, right? Were they aware of their faults? Were they aware of the strengths of other people around them? And what we found is vistas and beautiful views make college students more humble. Even though it's just a couple of minutes of the view, it makes them more humble. This vanishing of the self that awe produces, which the Japanese describe as kando, actually has been traced all the way down into the human brain, and it's really remarkable research. There's a region of your brain that you've probably been hearing about called the default mode network. And one way to think about one of the functions of the default mode network, which is a series of chunks of your cortex as you move in the middle of your brain from the front to the back, is that the default mode network kind of keeps you on task. It helps the self, me, Dacher Keltner, achieve my goals. So the default mode network is activated when I think about the present moment and my goals, what I'm going to do in the future. When I think about memories from my autobiographical past, this region of the brain is activated. And scientists now think of the default mode network as part of the self, right? Keeping track of things in the present environment. Quite remarkably, when people feel awe through deep experiences in nature or contemplation or mindfulness or even psychedelics with the research of Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins University, what we see across these awe-inspiring experiences is reduced activation in the default mode network. So the sense of self is starting to be diminished all the way down to these networks of parts of your brain. So as the self focus fades, as we experience awe, there are other things that ensue. We become more curious about other people. Our research shows that when people feel awe, they actually ask more questions of other people in the interactions that they're engaging in. You may really like this one. There are studies showing that when we feel awe and our sense of self fades, We have an expanded sense of time. It's as if we have more time to get the things done in our lives. We feel less everyday stress. Research from my lab shows, very importantly, as we feel awe and we experience less self-focus, the body's stress-related inflammation response, which produces cells that attack pathogens in your body, and it feels like a fever, really problematic to have chronically activated, awe lowers bodily inflammation. So the second question we can ask about what are the benefits of awe? What does it do for us? Is what does it do to our social relationships? And back to this broader argument that I'm making, which is that awe helps us fold into strong social collectives. One of the implications of that is that awe should really enhance or increase the likelihood of pro-social tendencies. Things like sharing, being cooperative, sacrificing for another person, and various forms of kindness. So here are some studies that really support this thesis that awe enhances pro-social tendencies. A first study Lonnie Sciotta did, she brought students to a part of the Berkeley campus. They stood next to this amazing T-Rex skeleton in our paleontology museum, or they stood in the same place, but they looked down a hallway, which wasn't so awe-inspiring. And what she found, she asked the participants in those two conditions, awe-inspired by the T-Rex, looking down the hallway, who are you as a person, right? And what you found is if you're standing next to the T-Rex, you really integrate yourself into humanity, right? You define yourself as being part of a group and part of a university and part of a species, and you're made of DNA and you're related to all sentient beings, right? If you're looking at the hallway, I've got these pressures and personal goals and characteristics. Awe makes us feel connected to others. Here's a great study demonstrating how awe actually makes us kinder and more pro-social as we fold into social collectives. It was carried out by Paul Piff down at UC Irvine, this was while he was at UC Berkeley. So what Paul and his colleagues did, and I was part of this study, is he very simply took undergraduates, and they're like, what are we doing? You know, and he brought them to this part of campus, and they got to look up into this beautiful grove of eucalyptus trees, which smell wonderfully and reflect light, have this beautiful presence. Or in another condition, they're standing in the same place, same time of day, and they're looking up at this science building, which is not so pretty, or awe-inspiring. Here's what Paul found, and it really is a remarkable testimony to the power of awe, even if it's just a minute or two. Paul surveyed people after looking up at the trees for a minute or two or at the building, and he found those people who had looked up into the trees felt less self-important. They felt less entitled. They kind of said the world doesn't owe them stuff. This is kind of funny. They actually needed less money to do this study. We paid them. We said, we're going to pay you $5. How much do you want? And they're like, I don't believe in money, you know, whatever the case may be. And then Paul very ingeniously, while they were doing this, this person walked by who was actually part of the study and kind of stumbled and dropped all these pens, and people feeling awe actually reached out and picked up more pens, right? And this complements other work Paul did showing brief experiences of awe make us share more, cooperate more, give to strangers more, and act in more altruistic fashion. So awe enhances our pro-social tendencies. So we've tried to answer a first question, which is what is awe, and differentiated it from related states. And then we've just thought about what does awe do for us, right? How does it sort of help us diminish self-interest and connect to others? And now we're going to turn to a deeper question in a way, which is why awe? In the deep story of the remarkable evolution of the human species, why in the world did we evolve this emotion, awe? We really owe a debt of gratitude to Charles Darwin for providing a conceptual framework for thinking about why did we evolve the particular emotions that we experience today. Darwin in 1872 was facing a lot of criticism, before that when he released his theory of evolution. And he was encountering criticism about how evolution would account for the emergence of particular human tendencies like the emotions. And so in response to his critics, Darwin published this remarkable book, The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, in 1872, in which he laid out this argument and really a description of all the different emotions that make up the human species. And he really laid out a couple of ways of answering this question of why do we have awe and where does it come from in our human and mammalian evolution. The first thing